You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, as NATO works through an unusually lengthy agenda in Cardiff, I'll be joined by Kathleen Burke and Ian Bond to discuss the alliance's options in Ukraine, Iraq and elsewhere.
There's a sense that, well, if this time we really do have to take some military action, then we've got to work it through properly so that the public understands what we're trying to do and agrees with it, and Parliament understands and agrees with it.
We'll also be checking in with our correspondent in Budapest.
The country is kind of besieged by globalism, and the driving force of globalism is, of course, the United States. So when you're against globalism, then that leads you to look at people who stand against that, and the prime force standing against that is Russia and China.
We'll find out what to look out for at a couple of upcoming art fairs in Sao Paulo, and No More Pillow Talk, a film that's sure to end in sleepless nights.
Who are you?
I'm your husband, Ben.
What?
You had an accident. You store up information for a day, wake up in the morning, it's all gone.
And other cinematic releases besides. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
Ukraine and pro-Russian rebels have agreed a ceasefire today, the first step towards ending a conflict in eastern Ukraine that has caused the worst standoff between Moscow and the West since the Cold War ended. The ceasefire took effect 2 hours ago at 1500 GMT and was agreed at peace talks in the Belarusian capital, Minsk. Meanwhile, NATO leaders meeting at the end of a summit in Wales have just heard France's president saying that sanctions against Russia will go ahead despite the ceasefire. NATO agreed to move towards the alliance's target of spending 2% of economic output on defence within a decade. The Ukraine crisis is one of the two main items on the agenda. The other is the threat posed by Islamic State militants in Iraq. NATO's Secretary General is Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
Today, we will ensure that we have the right forces and equipment in the right place for as long as required. And commitment to reverse the decline of our defence budgets, to share responsibilities for our security, and to enhance the vital transatlantic bond at the core of our alliance.
Monocle 24's Thomas Lewis, who is in South Wales, said that the United States will be trying to persuade other NATO members to join further military action against the militants.
You have 28 member states, and of course there are a variety of voices within that. I think there is some sort of sense that there is a momentum there, that the other members are willing to listen to President Obama, to Defence Secretary Chuck Hagel, to Secretary of State John Kerry, who are all here. But I think the need to build a nuanced response, as much as it is as a strong and robust one, is going to be, I think, quite a challenge for the President and his team.
Other news now, the Norwegian mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik, who showed no remorse at his trial for killing 77 people back in 2011, said today he was renouncing violence and was willing to apologise for his actions if he were allowed to set up a fascist party. In a 33-page long letter, Breivik said he was committed to bring about change by peaceful means and wanted to set up a party called the Norwegian Fascist Party and the Nordic League. An Estonian security officer was abducted during an operation to stop an illegal crossing on the Russian border today and taken at gunpoint across to Russia, Estonia's internal security service said in a statement. The foreign minister, Urmas Paet, said Tallinn had contacted Moscow about the incident on the border that in recent years has seen a number of incidents involving smuggling, illegal migration and weapons trafficking. Lufthansa was counting the cost of a second pilot strike in a week today, which forced the German airline to cancel just over 200 flights from Frankfurt Airport, Europe's third largest hub. The airline said the latest strike affected 25,000 passengers and would wipe millions of euros off profits. And finally, tributes are still pouring in for Joan Rivers, the American comedian who died on Thursday at the age of 81. Rivers went into stand-up comedy after writing sketches for television's The Ed Sullivan Show. She later became a regular guest host on NBC's The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson. Well, here is an example from that show.
Thank God you're in a good mood, because I had the worst night. I dreamt that Tom Selleck and my husband Edgar Rosenberg were fighting over me, and Edgar won. But my husband and I no longer see eye to eye. He doesn't find me sexually attractive anymore, okay? You want to know the truth? Last night I said to him, do you find me sexy? He said, I'd rather not find you at all.
That's the news here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:06. That's 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Ian Bond, Director of Foreign Policy at the Centre for European Reform. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the NATO summit in Cardiff, where it's unlikely any of the participants have been stuck for conversation. What with an incipient civil war in Libya, a pseudo-invasion of a sort of European country by Russia, and the conquest of a goodly portion of the Middle East by an outfit which has been castigated by Al-Qaeda for overdoing it on the Islamist extremism. We'll look first at where NATO currently stands as an organisation. I'll start by playing you both a clip from Jenny Mathers, who's head of international politics at Aberystwyth University in Wales. She's at the NATO summit, and she told our reporter Thomas Lewis it has largely been a success.
It shows that NATO is moving on a number of fronts quite quickly, which is unusual for NATO. NATO is quite an unwieldy organization. It has a large number of members, 28 at the moment, who have different perspectives. They've got different priorities. And so getting them all together to agree to some significant changes in, for example, their force posture, where they station their troops, what they're going to do with them, what their priorities are, these things usually take a very long time. And so to have quite a few decisions being on the cusp of being taken at the summit makes its significance much greater than a normal sort of gathering would be.
It's Jenny Mathers from Aberystwyth University talking to our reporter Thomas Lewis at the NATO summit. Kathleen, I'll ask you first, has NATO, or does this summit, I guess, show a perhaps overdue sense of urgency from NATO?
Well, many people would think it's overdue. One must remember, of course, you can take decisions. Whether you implement them in due course is the real crux here. There are countries who don't feel quite so threatened as others in NATO might do. They're going to drag their feet a bit. But yes, quite clearly, if you've decided you're going to have a coalition force, if you decided you're going to have a rapid reaction force and so forth, you might have sanctions. Yes, that is moving an awful lot for a dinosaur like NATO.
NATO is, you know, a dinosaur is quite a good description. It is very unwieldy. It takes a long time to move in any particular direction. Ian, that factor Kathleen mentioned about the different views of different things that 28 members will have, how much of a problem is it that the NATO members, with all the actual and, you know, the actual and diplomatic firepower, and the ones who would be called upon to contribute most should anything need to be done, are the ones furthest away from where things do need to be done?
I'm not sure it's the case that they're necessarily the farthest away from where things need to be done. Certainly in terms of where they have forces, the US has always had a lot of forces in the Middle East, and that's one of the areas where things need to be done. What I thought was quite interesting is that this declaration amounts to over 100 paragraphs. And when you look at the list of trouble spots, it stretches right the way around Europe from North Africa through the Middle East and up into
an arc of instability
Russia.
Was the phrase David Cameron used, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is not an overstatement. So you've got Mali in there, you've got Libya in there, you've got Syria, Iraq, Ukraine, Russia. And so, in a sense, I think every ally is facing some sort of problem, and the question is whether they can work together to tackle them all, either sequentially or indeed simultaneously.
Kathleen, and it's clearly part of the point of what Vladimir Putin has been doing to try and wrong-foot NATO over the last 5 or 6 months. Has NATO been badly wrong-footed, or has it done about as well as might have been expected?
Oh, it depends on how depressed you feel about NATO, I think. Wrong-footed, yes. I mean, the point is an autocracy can move much more quickly than a democracy, which can move more quickly than a congeries of democracies. There's been complacency, obviously. There's not been an obvious existential threat to any of the members of NATO, although a few, such as Turkey, possibly are beginning to feel a bit threatened in the last week or two. It's hard to know what you expect them to do. As I tried to say before, and I will say again, it has been interesting because almost not having happened in the past 10 years, the fast movement of NATO, relatively speaking, but I still say it's like countries contributing to overseas aid. They can pledge it, but will they actually produce it? And that I will be interested to see what happens over the next month or so.
Ian, is NATO equipped to deal with what we have seen over the last few months, which is not it's not the Cold War variety all out assault on the entire Western world. It has been a sequence of provocations, none of which in and of itself is really the sort of thing you start World War III over. And there's this story now breaking in the last few hours that an Estonian intelligence officer, depending on who you believed, it seems to be undisputed that he's been seized or taken away by Russian forces of some species or other. The Russians inevitably claim he was on Russian soil. The Estonians inevitably claim he was not. But again, that sounds... it's very easy to see that this is the kind of tail tweaking to which NATO can only react to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think the Estonian thing is probably just an unfortunate coincidence. I mean, I don't know what was happening there on the border. I think the allegation from the Russian side is that he was on a spying mission. The Estonians, I believe, have said that he was involved in an investigation of some criminal activity. And that's certainly a border where in the past there has been plenty of criminal activity. So it's possible. But I think that's just an unfortunate coincidence. No, NATO has been quite bad at reacting to the kind of creeping annexation of pieces of Ukrainian territory, and I think has underestimated the extent to which that is actually a threat to the Allies as a whole.
But just staying with that point, Ian, I mean, nobody was ever going to volunteer to fight World War III over a couple of towns in Ukraine. What else could or should NATO have done differently?
Well, the question is, what do you do to deter Russia from starting down that road? And that's where I think NATO failed at the very beginning. I think if NATO had said to the Ukrainians, as it were, at the end of February, when little green men popped up in Crimea, if you want to shoot these guys, we think that would be an excellent idea, then there's very little chance that Putin would have pressed on. They would have been portrayed as freelancers and they would have been disowned, instead of which they were able to take over. Putin saw that the reaction of the West was very weak, and we are now where we are. And nothing that we have done has changed his calculation that he can gain great benefits at low costs.
Kathleen, is there not still a problem with NATO, which I think I have heard expressed by various soldiers of various nationalities of various rank many times in the field, that there's NATO and there's NATO. There's the serious forces, by which most of the people who've groused along these lines to me tend to think of as the English-speaking ones, and there's everybody else. I particularly remember NATO soldiers or British and American ones in Kabul referring to the collective European armies as Euro Disney. But is there still a sense that this is basically a way for Europe to kind of rest while America picks up its national security tab?
Well, it depends what you mean by pick up its national security tab. I mean, certainly it seems to be a way. The thing is, if the United States is meant to be a leader, it has to lead. And if it's a leader, it's supposed to supply the money. And if it does supply the money, other countries don't have to supply the money. And if other countries don't feel threatened, and if they'd rather spend it on welfare, that's what they will do. NATO hasn't had a purpose for a long time, certainly not since 1989, 1991. And NATO members are out of the habit of thinking there is a purpose to NATO. And the scrambling to catch up with what is clearly a very appalling threat on two lines, Russia and the Middle East, means that people who aren't in the habit of thinking there's a problem are having to think there's a problem. And you have to learn how to cope with the problem. So I think NATO is going to be five or six countries, which might now include Turkey, and all the rest more or less scrambling.
Ian Bond, this proposed new rapid reaction force they're talking about, and as Kathleen was pointing out, there is a very, very, very big difference between, especially with a multinational organization, declaring something's going to happen and that thing then actually happening. I mean, you can't very well have a conference without declaring that something's going to happen. But even as it's portrayed, is that not an illustration of the same problem? There's serious contributors to NATO and not. They're talking about 4,000 troops, which will include 1,000 British soldiers commanded by a British general.
There will inevitably be a bigger contribution from the serious countries. For me, one of the questions is whether the Germans will step up, because in the Cold War, they were enormously important military contributors to the alliance, and they are the ones who more than anybody else have stepped back from that in the post-Cold War period. So that's a big question for me. But the penny packets of forces from countries which, as you say, you know, were described as Euro Disney in Afghanistan, I was never quite sure. I mean, politically, it's important to have a lot of flags, but in terms of military contribution, I'm not sure that it actually makes sense to have 20 countries contributing 10 or 20 people each, rather than having two or three big core nations in a unit like this new rapid reaction force. The question is whether the Europeans are going to take on more of the burden from the Americans, because the Americans are now bearing much more of the burden than they ever did in the Cold War. And I guess that for American public opinion, that's going to become more and more of a problem over time.
Okay, we'll move along slightly from this to talk about one of the specific challenges currently facing NATO. One non-NATO guest, one very prominent non-NATO guest at the summit has been Petro Poroshenko, president of Ukraine. In the last few hours, it has been announced that Ukraine and Russia's proxies in the east of the country have signed a truce in Minsk, which will hopefully end 5 months of fighting, which has left at least 2,600 people dead, not including the 298 passengers and crew of Flight MH17. Kathleen, Mariupol is still reported under fire. Does this truce seem like the sort of thing anyone should invest much hope in?
Well, there's two things. Perhaps you can invest hope in fighting stopping, but what you've got is what Putin can celebrate, a frozen crisis. That is to say, perhaps...
Along, I guess, the kind of Abkhazia model with Russian forces stationed more or less permanently in Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Georgia.
Well, possibly. I was thinking more of the fact that theoretically no one can do anything. But what that means is there is a continuing possibility for Russia to come in by saying the ceasefire isn't working or whatever. So what he can have is almost as good as now without people getting killed, with even less of a cost. So a ceasefire, yes, but a frozen crisis, also yes.
Ian, is this effectively a surrender by Kiev?
Something pretty close to it. And I understand why.
They can't win.
Well, because of the direct intervention of Russian regular forces, they were losing. And if it's right that the firing is still continuing at Mariupol, I was concerned earlier in the day, before the ceasefire entered into force, that what the Russians were trying to do in those last few hours was to get control of the most important city on that stretch of coastline, the most important port for Ukraine on that stretch of coastline, and it may be that they're still continuing to do that. We'll have to see. But I don't think we should invest too much in the chances of this ceasefire.
But at the risk of inviting you to see the world from inside the mind of Vladimir Putin, what more could he possibly want that he doesn't already have in Ukraine?
Well, Ukraine?
I mean, that in a sense is the $64,000 question. if you read some of Putin's speeches this year, there is a kind of messianic glint there about uniting the Russian world of a kind that no Western European statesman would ever feel comfortable delivering. And I don't think we should...
That's actually quite a good way of thinking about it. If we heard a François Hollande talking about uniting the French-speaking people, still less a German chancellor making broadly the same point, it would promote a certain amount of nervousness.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, for that matter, likewise, if the British Prime Minister announced that he had realised that Britain had lost, you know, the British were now a divided people and that they had to defend English speakers wherever they were in the world.
Would you like to be defended? Well, it's nice to have it as an ace in the hole. I mean, more slight than slightly worrying is not reports that have been coming out of Moscow, is that, and elsewhere, in fact, that Putin has also said that he has, of course, increased and much better nuclear forces, that he would be quite happy to land some small nuclear bombs or whatever in Europe to break NATO apart, and then what he really wants to do is to degrade and humiliate and destroy the United States. Now, this is perhaps a bigger glint than one might have thought, but it does show that at least in his at some points he has ambitions that go far beyond taking back Georgia and Ukraine.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Kathleen Burke and Ian Bond. When we return, we will find out whether NATO can do anything about another battleground that presently occupied by the Islamic State.
The Monocle Guide to Good Business is our new 300-page guide to founding, running and improving your business, from designing your corporate logo to finding a new HQ. And if you're a subscriber, we'd like to invite you to get your copy signed and share a drink with the editors as we head off on a global tour. We'll be starting off in Berlin on Monday the 8th of September, Paris at Maison et Objet on Tuesday the 9th, and Antwerp on Wednesday the 10th. If you'd like to come along and talk business with the Monocle team, go to monocle.com/book to find out more.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me here in the studio are Kathleen Burke and Ian Bond. Let's turn our attention now to the Islamic State, which is a phrase we may be sure has been uttered in Cardiff over the last couple of days. The question, I guess, now being asked is no longer really whether the UK and the US strike at ISIS in Syria, but when. This is what Michael Clarke, director of the Royal United Services Institute, had to say earlier.
The fact is that Downing Street completely mishandled the leadership aspect of the Syria vote last year. And there's a sense that, well, if this time we really do have to take some military action, then we've got to work it through properly so that the public understands what we're trying to do and agrees with it, and Parliament understands and agrees with it. And that is happening. It seems to me that opinion is shifting relatively rapidly towards the sense that military action may have to follow. I think President Obama and the administration has got exactly the same problem as the Prime Minister, that if this time round, this year, they have to ask for a coalition for military action against Islamic State, they must get it right. They cannot seem to be ambiguous or back away from commitment. So a great deal of negotiations are going on in the background between the United States and its partners. And when a package is announced, that there is no kickback from either the publics or other members of NATO. So they must avoid the mistakes of last year.
Michael Clarke from RUSI. Kathleen, I'll ask you first, is there any way that something resembling full-scale war against the Islamic State can actually be avoided?
Full-scale war by whom?
Well, it is one of the key questions. But in the absence of any likely volunteers, I mean, we could talk about the Arab League, but really, it will be a NATO-Western-led intervention.
Well, what Obama has said is that it's not a question of destroying the state. Pardon me. It's a question of containing it. And so, therefore, you're going to bomb around the edges and hope they don't go past whatever crevices you bomb. Yes, of course, one can withhold from full war, but what you've got is a series of little civil wars. And this is very difficult to get involved in because you're not quite sure who you're supposed to back, what you're supposed to back, why you're supposed to back. So it's probably safer just to try to contain, and as well, which is interesting, to try to up the ante in terms of intelligence, because what the West has really lacked is a lot of specific intelligence, not only what's happening there, but what's happening here as well.
Ian, I'll ask you, I guess, the same question in a slightly different way. If military intervention, even more than we've already seen, was undertaken against the Islamic State, what would success look like?
One definition of success would be no attacks on our own soil. That's a minimal definition, but it's a possible definition. But going further than that, you would look, I think, for at least the stabilization of Iraq. And Syria is much, much more difficult to do anything about. But the intervention of the Islamic State in Iraq has been something which came quite quickly, which was driven by the mistakes made by Prime Minister Maliki in the way that he ran the country.
Indeed.
And you can see that through support for the Kurds and Kurdish forces, and through the support which NATO has said it will give if it's asked, training and improving the capabilities of the Iraqi forces, you might actually be able to push back on the Islamic State within the territory of Iraq. But Syria is a much more difficult challenge. And one of the things that strikes me is that we have not heard a lot from Turkey about what either it could do or what it would like the rest of us to do to help us to control its border, so that you don't have the flow of foreign jihadis and weapons and so on into the area.
One country we have heard from in the last day or two, interestingly, has been Iran, whose chief thunderbolt thrower, Ayatollah Khamenei, has agreed to allow Iran to coordinate military operations with the US, Kurdistan and Iraq. It's nice to see people getting on. Can the Islamic State survive at all when basically everybody around it seems to really wish it wasn't there and wish they would go away? Can they really fight off half a dozen surrounding actual countries?
Well, of course, again, one might see IS as acting in a sense analogous to Putin. That is to say, the Islamic State, or whatever you wish to call it, celebrates brutality, because it knows that it will be able to intimidate and frighten any possible opponents unless something really happens. Putin isn't going to be brutal like that, but he knows he can do things that the opposition will not stop, because they don't, whether it's the will or the courage or the backing or whatever you want to say. So, yes, that particular Islamic State can, I think, stand for quite a long time, just because it's surrounded by countries, A, who are racked internally themselves, and B, cannot force themselves to be as brutal as is necessary against a brutal state.
Ian, how big a concern for any Western intervention against the Islamic State, especially if it includes airstrikes within Syria, is avoiding the appearance or the actual or the actuality of effectively acting as Bashar al-Assad's air force?
President Obama was clearly very sensitive on that point in his press conference after the NATO summit, and he was talking a lot about the support that the US would give to the Free Syrian Army. Now, my view is that if he had supported the Free Syrian Army effectively 3 years ago, we would not now be in the mess that we are. But better late than never. If there's still people that he can find who are capable of fighting, that's great. But President Assad has from the very beginning been part of the problem. The reason that some of these Islamic State fighters are on the battlefield is that at the beginning of this crisis, Assad pretty much wiped the floor with his moderate opponents. And so the more extreme elements were able to rise to the top by saying, well, these guys were just softies. When we start cutting a few heads off, things will change. Now, things have changed, but generally for the worse.
Kathleen, final thought from you on this. John Kerry, US Secretary of State, has been talking about, mixing his cliches and metaphors here, he's talking about no boots on the ground as a red line. Is he kidding himself, really?
Well, it's very difficult. He's not kidding himself because there were no boots over the red line when, said if the chemical weapons in Syria, that would be a red line and it wasn't stepped over. So I think mixed metaphors possibly mean mixed results in due course.
We'll have to leave it there. Kathleen Burke and Ian Bond, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tóquio. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's show. We'll speak to our man in Budapest. We will whip through a few exhibitions in Sao Paulo and review the latest cinematic openings in London. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. Ukraine and pro-Russian rebels have agreed to a ceasefire today, the first step towards ending a conflict in eastern Ukraine that has caused the worst standoff between Moscow and the West since the Cold War ended. The ceasefire took effect 2.5 hours ago at 1500 GMT. The Norwegian mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik, who showed no remorse at his trial for killing 77 people back in 2011, said today he was renouncing violence and was willing to apologise for his actions if he were allowed to set up a fascist party in Norway. An Estonian security guard was abducted during an operation to stop an illegal crossing on the Russian border today and taken at gunpoint. Tallinn has contacted Moscow about the incident. And Lufthansa was counting the cost of a second pilot strike in a week on Friday, which forced the German airline to cancel just over 200 flights from Frankfurt Airport, Europe's third largest hub. And that's the news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House, live here from Studio One at Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, which makes it 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Budapest, where shortly before we came to air, I spoke to our correspondent there, Adam Labor. We began by discussing Hungarian politicians and the somewhat surprising reactions of some of them to the crisis in Ukraine.
Laszlo Kövér, the Speaker of the House, well, he's certainly what you'd say on the right wing of the ruling Fidesz party, which is a right-wing conservative party anyway. But it's a very strange metamorphosis that on the right wing of the party, which is very nationalistic, they've gone sort of anti-Western, which means in a default sense they've gone much more pro-Russia than you might expect. And already Viktor Orban, the prime minister's, got into some trouble over his reluctance initially to have sanctions against Russia, and he's also made it known that he doesn't think that this is such a great idea. And now the Speaker of the Parliament has said something like that the whole Ukraine crisis was an externally manipulated process, and even compared it, according to some reports, to a circus. So I don't think it's a circus to the people in Mariupol or Donetsk who are being shelled.
It wasn't a circus to people in Budapest in 56 either. Where is this coming from? I mean, the emergence of a certain crankiness in Hungarian politics in the last few years has been quite well chronicled. But what is driving this? Why do they feel sympathetic to Russia all of a sudden? Is it just that anti-Western tendency you mentioned?
Yeah, I think there's definitely the Hungarian nationalism leads itself. This strain of it sees the country as kind of besieged by globalism. And the driving force of globalism is, of course, the United States. So when you're against globalism and the mass kind of consumer culture that people say they see appearing all over the world, then that leads you to look at people who stand against that. And the prime force standing against that is Russia and China. But earlier, last month, the Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, gave a speech in Romania to young ethnic Hungarians there, because there's 500,000 or so Hungarians living in Romania. in which he said that Hungary wouldn't be a liberal kind of democracy, and it would remain a democracy, but not a liberal one in the sense of Western orthodoxy of what liberal democracy means. Now, this caused a huge furore also across the EU, especially in Germany and in Scandinavia. So we've seen these signs before, which some people are finding quite worrying, actually.
But this is very strange, though, because in many respects, Hungary has seemed an absolutely enthusiastic, an enthusiast, if you will, for a lot of those, for joining various Western clubs like the EU and NATO. And certainly Hungary's removal from the Warsaw Pact to where it is now, it is a vastly more prosperous country than it was when I first visited it in 1990.
Yes, I mean, it's a completely transformed place now, 25 years on after the collapse of communism. But there's been a change in politics. You know, politics grows and evolves, and often it's a process of reaction. So what you saw in the early 1990s was the reaction against communism. So the driving force on all sides, right, left and center, was to lock Hungary into the European Union and NATO. But now, 25 years down the line, the country is more stable and prosperous and is finding its voice. And it's reverting back to a kind of nationalism, which might perhaps be a more authentic form of what Hungarians believe and want. I mean, none of this is doing the governing party any harm. I mean, they're still by far leading in the polls. The opposition, the left-wing opposition, is fractured into three or four groups. And the second biggest party is Jobbik, the far-right party, which offers an even stronger pro-Russia and pro-China and pro-Iran type of politics. So, there's a market for this.
Okay, well, let's look at a story, a more local politics story, local to where you are in Budapest. We have a left-wing candidate for the mayor's job in Budapest. Does he have a chance at all or not?
No, I'd say he has zero chance. And one reason he has zero chance is that if you consider that the election, the local elections, including the elections in Budapest, are on October the 12th, which is like 5 weeks away, it's taken the fractious left this long to select a candidate, and a candidate who, frankly, is completely unknown. I mean, he sounds like he's a very good and ethical, person, but the idea that he's going to beat an incumbent mayor with who got the support of the governing party behind him is just frankly bizarre, and it's another step on the Hungarian left and liberal party's slow but certain road to electoral suicide.
Well, just finally, one of the, I guess, advantages that the incumbent mayor does have on his side is that, at least by one estimation, Budapest, which is a fantastic and beautiful city, of course, is moving up the ranks of livable cities.
Yes, in the latest index, it's moved up from 55 to 50. And it's true, the place is extremely livable. You know, there's fantastic public transport, wonderful trams, which I think are by far the best way to get around town. We've now got one of those, the bicycle schemes where you can hire a bike somewhere and then take it somewhere else. There's more and more cycle paths, and ever more restaurants and bars and cafes opening up. It's an extremely civilized Liverpool place, great cultural life, wonderful live music, classical music scene here as well. Theatre. So, I mean, really, there's, everything that you could want is here.
And that was Adam Labor in Budapest. Up next, we'll be heading to Sao Paulo for the Biennale and other events besides. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
A And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's just gone 18:39 here in London. Sao Paulo is well known as a city that overloads the senses, but in the next few days, more so than usual. Sao Paulo's Biennale opens tomorrow, followed on Tuesday by Cidade Matarazzo, featuring around 100 artists, who are displaying their work in a massive, derelict, empty hospital. Well, joining me now to tell me more is Claire Rigby. Claire, let's start with the Biennale, because that starts tomorrow. What can people who might be in the vicinity expect from that?
Hi, Andrew. I think the Biennale is always incredibly impressive. It's an immense exhibition. And this year, I think it's quite a difficult exhibition. It's very political. There's some really challenging exhibits there. And I think it also it demands quite a lot of viewers in an excellent way. It's not, you know, it's not immediate. It's not kind of crowd-pleasing stuff throughout, although there's plenty of beautiful work to look at. There's also quite a lot of stuff for people to engage with intellectually, which is the aim of the curators this year.
When you say it's quite political, in what respect? Is that reflecting the current presidential election or the demonstrations that attended the World Cup, or neither or both?
I think not really those things. It's actually a bit more even ambitious than that. It's got a kind of a huge international scope. The curators, there's a group of five curators who've prepared this exhibition, and they're very international. It's the British curator Charles Esch, two Israelis and two Spanish working as a team. So in terms of politics, it's quite sort of internationalist. It covers subjects like women's rights and abortion, gender, religion, and all sorts, and as I say, in quite challenging ways.
Staying with the Biennale, or the Biennale rather, I know it's Biennale in some cities, it's Biennale in Sao Paulo. What are you most looking forward to seeing yourself?
Well, I've actually had a preview, because there was a press preview this week, but there's so much there that really, you know, it was kind of a drive-by preview. You had to just try and get around and see as much as possible. I think what I'm looking forward to going back and having a closer look at are, one of the works in particular by Yael Bartana, which is an incredible film set here in Sao Paulo, in which it's imagined, and actually, you know, you see it happening in front of your eyes, the Temple de Solomon, which was built here and inaugurated just last month, is destroyed. It's a really beautiful film, and one to sort of sit down and sort of soak up.
We should also talk about, I guess, the political controversy that attended the Biennale, which is that some artists got upset. In fact, quite a lot of them got upset about the fact that it was receiving sponsorship from the embassy from Israel in Brazil. We've seen similar arguments in a couple of places in Europe over the last few months, especially. How was this resolved, or indeed was it resolved?
It was resolved, and it's interesting because the curatorial team has talked a lot about conflict and wanting to kind of provoke some sort of arguments and debate and conflict around the Biennale and around their choice of artists and stuff. So, you know, it was interesting and very appropriate that there should have been this this controversy just on the eve of its opening, really. So I think 55 of the 86 artists objected when they saw the late inclusion of the Israeli embassy as one of the sponsors. They had a kind of week of plenary sessions and long meetings, and eventually there was a compromise reached where the Biennale agreed that the money from the Israeli embassy would only be going to the artists involved, the Israeli artists who'd actually received that money, that they wouldn't be general sponsors. The artists were really, I think they were quite pleased with the result, and actually one of them said to me, "We were so desperate that this wouldn't overshadow some of the other really interesting political issues that we're trying to bring up." So, you know, all around, they seem quite pleased with it.
Well, let's move along to the Cidade Matarazzo. First of all, I wanted to talk about, or at least get you to tell us about, the building where this is being held, which sounds pretty spectacular.
It's a beautiful building. It's really, really unusual in Sao Paulo in that it's survived. Sao Paulo famously tends to knock down historic buildings and kind of verticalize, and, you know, it's a very vertical city. In this case, this is a massive plot of land. It's 3 hectares, just off Avenida Paulista, which is one of the most expensive parts of Sao Paulo. It's a disused hospital that's been there. It's been closed for 20 years and has been taken over by, I think there's 91 artists who are just occupying every bit of it. It's a really, really stunning exhibition.
And what kind of things are you looking forward to seeing at that one?
Well, again, I've had a little look because they've had the press in to take a look. There's one, I mean, there are just countless gorgeous artworks there, but one in particular that just stayed with me was the Brazilian artist Arthur Lesher. They've taken one of the buildings that's going to be demolished, which very few of them will be, but this particular building is marked for demolition. And he's created a rain installation where it's raining inside the building, it's raining on the first floor, and the rain's filtering through to the ground floor and filling that up. It's just stunning. It's stunning visually, you know, it's an audio installation as well. It's really beautiful.
Claire Rigby from in Sao Paulo, rather. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House, coming up for 18:45 here in London. Time now for some music. We will stay in Brazil with an ode to Sao Paulo. This is Sampa by the great Caetano Veloso.
Quilombo de zumbi e os novos baianos passeiam na tua garoa. E novos baianos te podem curtir numa boa.
Caetano Veloso with Sampa. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Coming up, film.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Coming up for 18:49 in London, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, getting on for the end of the show, which means it's time to take a look at some or other aspect of the arts. Today it's the turn of film, and joining me once again to discuss the latest on the silver screen is Anna Smith, film reviewer for London's Metro newspaper. Anna, we'll start with a film which I have not seen, but about which I have read, and what I have read about it leads me to believe that I may never see it. Am I making a correct judgment? This is Before I Go to Sleep.
Before I Go to Sleep. If you're not into schlocky thrillers, then I suspect so. It's really dividing critics. But I have to say, I'm one of the one in the yes camp. I liked it.
So your quotes will end up on the poster without them having without having to be tactfully edited.
Yes, exactly. Not taken out of context. Yes. So Nicole Kidman stars, as you will be aware. She plays a woman who's got amnesia. It's very much like Memento. Remember the film Memento?
I kept thinking as well of, isn't there like 50 First Dates
or something? It is. It's like a very serious version of 50 First Dates without Adam Sandler.
There is their poster quote, a serious version of 50 First Dates without Adam Sandler.
Yes, which is going to be a good thing.
Well, if they just put the without Adam Sandler on the poster, yeah, that would work.
Yeah, and it's got Colin Firth and Mark Strong, so pretty good cast. She tries to piece together the parts of her past because she wakes up every day and she can't remember the last 15 years. So she's not any surprised to be 40 years old, but she's surprised to be married to Colin Firth. So there's various surprises, and she kind of finds video diaries where she discovers that she's left for herself and left clues as to what's going on.
Well, Nicole Kidman presumably really enjoyed this role because it means she would wake up every morning forgetting about Grace of Monaco. We do have a clip from it.
My name is Christine Lucas and I'm an amnesiac. Tonight, as I sleep, my mind will erase everything I know today. I'm scared. Who are you?
I'm your husband, Ben.
What?
You had an accident. You store up information for a day. Wake up in the morning, it's all gone.
You described it, Before I Go to Sleep, that is, and that is a fate-tempting title. You described it as a schlocky thriller.
Mm-hmm.
It does sound a bit silly.
It is far-fetched, definitely. It's based on a book by S.J. Watson, which was actually inspired by a real woman's condition, but I dare say she didn't go through the traumas that this film involves. You have to suspend your disbelief, but there's enough action and very, very good performances to keep you interested if you're a fan of twisty-turny thrillers.
Worth seeing, really, on balance?
Yeah, for me, I'd say yes, it is.
Okay. Well, we'll move along to Life of Crime. Which, I mean, I really need you to tell me that they haven't managed to screw up an Elmore Leonard.
They haven't okay. done the very best job they possibly could have done. But it is, you know, it's a quite strangely slow direction in editing. Not quite sure whether it's a comedy caper, a thriller or a drama. But when it's funny, it's very funny. And it's one of Jennifer Aniston's best roles in a while, actually, because she often chooses quite dodgy comedies. And she plays a nicely kind of downplayed role as a housewife who is kidnapped by a couple of inept kidnappers. And then hilariously, her husband isn't particularly interested in paying the ransom. So these kidnappers are stuck with the victim and have no clue what to do.
Because it is, with any adaptation of Elmore Leonard, this is such a tough balance, because while his books are thrillers, they are also often really very, very funny, very dialogue-driven, very waspish, very sharp. And when you get it right on the screen, I'm thinking even of something like the TV series Justified, which has been extrapolated from one Elmore Leonard short story, but does manage to be that thing of... Yeah, you can read it as a detective thriller, and you can also enjoy it as a comedy. Do they get the balance more or less right here?
I don't think, as a whole, they don't. It's still a kind of 3 stars out of 5 film because the source material and the performances are very good. But I think something like Get Shorty is a better example of what to do with an Elmore Leonard film. You know, that got the comedy tone just right.
Indeed.
And it was zippy. You know, this is a little bit slow. You know, the farcical moments are undeniably funny. And there's a great cast, Tim Robbins as well, and Isla Fisher.
Okay, well, we have a clip from Life of Crime.
Yeah.
Frank?
Tomorrow morning, you're going to go to the bank and draw $1 million out of your account and deposit to account number 89. Slow down. What am I, a stenographer?
$1 million? It's just not going to happen.
What do you mean?
Should I get it?
Do you want me to get it?
Maybe you should get it. I'll get it.
I'm getting it. I'm afraid Mr. Dawson isn't here right now.
This Melanie with the big... The woman would have hung up the phone on us.
From Life of Crime there. You mentioned Jennifer Aniston's performance. She's one of those there are people in the world deserving possibly of greater sympathy than millionaire Hollywood actors. But because partly through no fault of her own, she has become better known for just existing than she is for what she actually does. It does often get forgotten that at her very best, thinking of things like the best of the peak episodes of Friends and the unjustly overlooked Office Space, but a very influential film. She's a terrific comic actress.
She is, absolutely. She knows when to sort of underplay it and when to really go for it. And it's really nice to see her to given that chance, even though most of the time she's the foil in this. You got Mos Def being quite funny and John Hawkes. But yeah, I mean, it's terrific to see her finally make a reasonably good comedy choice.
Is this a film, finally, that one pays money to see, or is this a film that you get on with the rest of your life for year and a half or so and wait for it to turn up on television or on an aeroplane?
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I wouldn't feel ripped off if I paid to go and see this, but I wouldn't feel that I'd missed out if I didn't. It's a bit more of a DVD one, to be absolutely honest with you.
Okay, that is a shame, because Elmore Leonard, you would like to think people can do better with. We'll move along, finally, to the 100-foot journey. Again, you possibly have a persuasion job to do here, because everything I've read about it, I confess I have not seen it, everything I've read about it made me not only to want to not see the film, but actually to go out and set fire to local cinemas for fear that they may actually consider showing it at some point.
I'm not going to attempt to persuade you to see this one. It is very sentimental, and it's very much aimed at that kind of middle brow, isn't the south of France absolutely glorious kind of market. Helen Mirren, as you'll be aware, plays a French restaurateur, rather bizarrely why she plays a French woman, I don't know, who comes up against an Indian family who open a curry house across the road. So it's the posh French restaurant, and the down-to-earth Indian people. And of course, in the end, we all know they're going to get along just fine.
This is going to be one of those comedies of manners, opposites attracting kind of...
Exactly.
Okay, having given it the big sell there, we should have a clip from it.
Bonjour. This is private property.
Excuse me, do you own this property?
No.
Oh, that means you are trespassing too.
100 feet across the street, the restaurant has a Michelin star. The President of France dines there.
Can Mr. President order murgh masala, cooked the way Hassan cooks?
People here don't eat those things.
They have never tried. Now they shall.
We open Saturday night. My son is the best Indian chef in Europe. Raise your hand. Don't feel shy.
Don't raise your hand.
Raise your hand, Hassan. I'm talking to you.
Okay, in the space of one extremely short clip, I was mentally logging all the incredibly irritating films that reminded me of, and I've come up with Love Actually, Crossing Delancey,
Was it Year in Provence ever a film, or is that something else that annoyed the hell out of me that I'm thinking of?
Yeah, there's been a few Provence set ones that definitely, yeah. And Chocolat, actually, is the same director.
There's another.
Yeah, yeah.
From where does come this apparently inexhaustible appetite for this sort of glop?
Well, I don't know. I mean, is it kind of the Blue Rinse Brigade, as we used to call them, the Grey Pound, as they call it now? You know, the best exotic Marigold Hotel, which was actually, I thought, pretty good film, was aimed at that market. But now there seems to be kind of substandard films, as you suggest, coming out for that very sort of, you know, comfort food TV, comfort food film, you know.
That appears to be literally the case in this one. But, I mean, there is a time and a place for the sort of, like, sentimental, feel-good, let's... Because I'm assuming, at the risk of spoiling anyone's enjoyment, everybody at the end gets on fine and they all live happily ever after. And everybody's learnt a little something from somebody else and everyone's a little bit wiser and richer for the experience, etc., right?
Yeah, it's a feel-good film. It's a complete fantasy. You don't really believe any of it would actually happen. But if you want to go and feel that life is wonderful and everyone can just get along, then, it could be worse.
The 100-Foot Journey, starring Helen Mirren, somewhat inexplicably, as a French restaurateur, Anna Smith from Metro. Thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on this edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Kathleen Burke and Ian Bond, who talked us through the NATO summit and matters arising. Today's show was produced by Marika Peters, researched by Carlotta Ribello and Gaia Lutz, and our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. I'll be back at 2200 hours tonight with Nancy Durham for the Monocle Daily. This show returns on Monday at 1800 London time, I think, hosted by me again, you lucky people. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.